Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The mutual microphones bring you at this time an address by Chairman Frank R. McNinch of the Federal Communications Commission. This broadcast is originating in the offices of Chairman McNinch in the new post office building on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington. His subject for this evening is radio today and tomorrow. Chairman McNinch will discuss some of the past and present problems of the broadcasting industry and the future outlook. He will also deal with the impending investigation of chain or network broadcasting and monopoly in the broadcasting industry, which investigation will open on Monday, November 14th. Chairman McNinch will discuss also the reorganization of the Communications Commission staff, which has been marked by some as a purge. This broadcast is being carried coast to coast by the Mutual Network, and now we present Chairman Frank R. McNinch.
Good evening, everybody. If there were any question before the country of more fundamental and more far-reaching importance than what all of us are to do about radio, probably I should not be talking to you tonight. If there had not been troubles in radio, and in the Federal Communication Commission, too, if there had not been a reorganization, a purge, as some called it, I should not be taking up the time which the broadcasters have been good enough to place at my disposal. But radio is tremendously important, and the troubles and the reorganization have occurred. Tonight I want to tell something about how they occurred and why. I hope I may make clearer what they mean to radio and what they mean to you as a citizen. These things affect the radio of today. They play their part in shaping the radio of tomorrow. For most of us, radio has become a vital part of our daily lives. It grows more and more important every day. Yet a host of questions surround it about which few persons altogether agree. There is not even unanimity about the value of radio as we have it today. There are millions who love it for the entertainment value and its accomplishments, which so short time ago we would have called miraculous. They smile indulgently at its imperfections. Many others decry it, complain loudly and bitterly of its being too often trivial and ineffective, or that it is being abused or misused. But no intelligent person can be indifferent to it, because it affects so intimately our own lives and those of our children, and promises to affect them yet more profoundly in the coming years. It is in a remarkably short time, radio has taken first rank as a means of mass communication. In taking that rank, in reaching deeper and deeper into our daily lives, radio has raised up many new problems for all of us. Some of them are inherent in the nature of the industry. There is radio's all but miraculous quality. Its private and fairly well-distributed ownership, how widely we will know better a little later. There is its use of frequencies or radio waves that are a part of the public domain, with only a limited public control over the use which is made of that public domain. And especially, there is that quality of public trusteeship that surrounds the use of radio and is heightened by the very sketchiness of the public control. The problems of radio are for all of us to solve, especially the Congress of the United States, the Federal Communications Commission, the broadcasters, and the nation's millions of radio listeners. Just what part each of these agencies or groups shall play in solving these problems, in making radio a more useful servant, reporter, and educator for all of us, is not yet clear. But it is clear that the problems must be solved, and that some measure of leadership in solving them must be exercised by the Federal Communications Commission with its limited powers of regulation through the licensing of broadcasting stations. 13 months ago, President Roosevelt presented me with the opportunity and the challenge to help to guide the development and the use of radio as chairman of this commission. The assignment was broader than that, for the commission must deal also with the problems of telephone and telegraph. But the task of which I will speak tonight is that of charting a course of constructive regulation and the formulation of policies for the guidance of the broadcasting industry. I'm still working with my associate commissioners on that task. I am going to stay on it until it is done, to the satisfaction of the President, and I hope of the Congress, and of others who are most concerned. It is, of course, true that after the job is done and the President is ready to entrust it to other hands, I hope to return to the Federal Power Commission from which I came. That, however, will come after, but not before, my important assignment here is finished. And before I leave, I hope and firmly believe that my associates and I will have gone a long way toward solving the immediate problems that confront us. In this, we will be aided by the reorganization and the reforms within the Federal Communications Commission that we have now about finished putting into effect. Now first, what was wrong? And why was there any need for reorganization or reform? I was told at the outset that many things were wrong. There was a scramble for licenses and renewal of licenses. Many of the applications were contested, sometimes bitterly, as they are still and perhaps always will be. To deal with this difficult situation, the commission had a staff which was not coordinated. Responsibility was divided and not centered squarely upon the whole commission, as I felt and the commission concluded, good administrative practice required. The work on cases was far behind, and there was an accumulation of undecided applications. During the year, we have decided over 400 of such cases. The arrangement for the conduct of hearings on license applications was such as to keep the hearings remote from the commissioners upon whom responsibility for final decisions rested. An applicant for a license or his attorney would usually know in advance what member of the staff would hear the application. He was in a position to approach this staff member, an examiner, or have others approach him, an attempt to bring influence to bear. He might learn in advance what the recommended decision was, or was likely to be, before the commissioners ever saw any papers in the case, or gave any consideration to its merits. Some members of Congress interviewed privately members of the commission, or staff members, submitting information or recommendations without putting any supporting evidence in the records. When cases at last came before the commission, the commissioners were not always certain whether the commission had all the pertinent information, and it was not certain whether the proper relative weight had been given to such information as was presented. I do not know of any attempt deliberately to mislead the commission, but I do know that many of the cases which came up were not in any form satisfactory to a conscientious commissioner eager to deal out equal justice and guard the public weal. There were many rumors afloat that commission action was being influenced through persuasive approaches to some members of the staff. To correct such bad conditions as were known to exist and to prevent the possibility of those that were rumored or suspected, a number of steps were taken. As chairman of the commission, I proposed reforms. Almost always, most of the commissioners, and at a few times all of them, cooperated with me. Always the changes were ordered, of course, by a vote of the commission. There has been no undue haste, and I am confident no ill-advised action. My task, as I have indicated, was particularly to help chart a course of constructive regulation and the formulation of policies. In charting the course, and especially in reorganizing the commission staff where it needed reorganization, we have not been precipitate. I knew very little about radio when I came. Who does? I took time to inform myself fully about each phase of the subject. As many of you know, radio means not merely the broadcasts you hear every day, but communications between ships at sea and between ship and land. Then there are the networks of police communications, the more than 40,000 amateur hams, the direction beams, the weather reports for aviation, and the experimental television and facsimile transmission. In addition to radio, the complex regulatory problems of the telephone and telegraph fields have been delegated to the commission. I had to look into them, too. I was sure it would be a mistake to wade right in and institute sweeping changes without knowing precisely what was wrong, what delicate mechanisms I might kick over, and how the changes would affect the public service. First, it was necessary to speed up the consideration of and decision upon hundreds of pending cases. That was done. This important phase of the Commission's work was made current, or practically so, to the decided advantage of radio broadcasters and radio listeners. The telephone, telegraph, and broadcast divisions, which served no useful purpose, and in fact interfered with and slowed down the work of the Commission, were abolished. This ended divided responsibilities among commissioners and gave to each commissioner the right and the duty to participate in the whole work of the Commission. The heads of these divisions were dismissed, and the work was merged into a single organic whole. An order was issued requiring that any representation made by anybody in any case, whether a congressman, an attorney, a lobbyist, be made a part of the record in that case. We sought to bring everything out in the open and have nothing hidden. I do not think we have succeeded 100%, but I am satisfied that we have improved conditions a very great deal. After further close study of the problems by myself and my fellow commissioners, I was prepared to initiate, and they to join me in, a few other important changes. It was intended to make these changes about July the 1st. Unfortunately, I became ill and lost nearly 3 months' time. It was not until my return to duty within the last few weeks that I was able to initiate measures to complete, or largely complete, the reorganization of the Commission's administrative setup. But that is done now, in the main, anyway. And now the Communications Commission is going to town. The most important of the changes made 3 days ago was the abolishment of the examining division. Formerly, the great majority of cases were decided by the Commission upon consideration of recommendations made by the examiners. Under the new practice, each hearing will be conducted by the Commission, by a commissioner, or by a board composed of one or more suitably qualified employees. The Commission, instead of the person who presided at the hearing, will file a proposed report of findings of fact and conclusions of law in each case, which report will then become public. Opportunity will be afforded after the filing of the exceptions and for oral argument before the Commission issues its final report or order. I'm convinced that it is not desirable to have a definite, separate group of employees known as examiners to hear the evidence and report thereon with recommendations as to the granting or denial of applications for licenses. The majority of the Commission feels that it is much better to refer each application to the commissioners or other suitably qualified persons. Under our new plan, no one will know in advance who is to conduct the hearing on a particular license application. Even more important, the record of evidence will be transferred to the Commission. The Commission itself, instead of a staff member, will study the evidence before any report is made, and, of course, will make the final decision. We regard this as a long step towards the assurance of fair and just decisions upon all applications. It provides the fair play which the Supreme Court requires by its decisions in the Morgan and other cases, that fair play which every fair-minded man wants. This reform and all of the others have two broad purposes. They are, first, greater efficiency, and second, the utmost protection attainable against possible improper influence by those having business with the Commission. In effecting these changes, as often happens, some men lost their jobs. That's where the so-called purge comes in. Now let's see about this purge. In all the reorganization of the administrative setup that has taken place in the last 13 months, the men who have lost their jobs number exactly 7. Right here, if you believe the misleading and downright inaccurate accounts that a few of the newspapers, not many, have published, you may expect to find the mangled corpse of the merit system. Well, try to find it. Of the total men, total of 7 men, 4 held jobs, positions rather, that were wholly exempt from civil service. One of these positions was that of general counsel. The other 3 were $7,500 positions, which were purely political appointments, soft snaps. The 3 men were gentlemen of unimpeachable character, but as heads of the divisions, they had little to do. Abolishing these 3 jobs certainly was no ravishment of civil service. It simply slammed the door, 3 doors shut, through which men could enter into the Communications Commission on the staff positions without civil service qualification. The remaining 3 men did have civil service positions, but the departments in which they worked were abolished by the reorganization plan, and they did not fit in elsewhere. These few simple facts are enough to demonstrate that the purge was in no sense directed against civil service or the merit system. It is always painful to separate a man from his job, even if the job is not very useful, and it is plainly in the public interest to abolish it. I tried to help all those who were dropped, who asked for help, and even some who did not ask. But to represent the separations as a war upon civil service is just a smokescreen. It has been intimated, too, that politics played some part in this reorganization. It played no part whatsoever. Of all the 7 men who had been dropped, civil service and non-civil service, 6 are Democrats. The other is a Republican, or used to be. Just to nail another false report, the Republican whose post was abolished was quoted in some newspapers as telling how I tried, as I did, to help him get another position paying about $5,000. He was reported as saying, I quote, "When I demurred, Mr. McNinch told me he thought that the $5,000 job was good enough for any Republican. So you can see how the whole thing operates." Close the quote. That account is wholly untrue. I never made any such statement. What I told him when he refused the $5,000 job was that thousands of men with families were living on smaller salaries than that. There yet remains the task of reassigning some members of the staff to other positions where they may render better service, and of dismissing any who are definitely inefficient. No man has a right to hold a job and draw his salary from the public treasury unless he has the ability, equipment, and industry to earn his salary. Public office, whether great or small, is a public trust, and those who have administrative responsibility owe it to the public to see that the public gets a dollar's service for the dollar paid. So much for reorganization. Now a word about the occasional charge that politics affect radio stations and programs, the silly stories about supposed administration interference. I've read stories to the effect that the present administration sought to and even did influence the Communications Commission in the administration of its regulatory duties for partisan political purposes. I want to nail that canard squarely on the head. I've been chairman of the commission for 13 months, and during the nationwide campaign leading up to the election last Tuesday. And I say to you, categorically, without qualification or reservation, that not a single suggestion of political favoritism has come to me from anyone in the White House or the administration, nor from any political organization. Furthermore, neither the president nor any member of his family, nor any of the secretaries to the president, nor anyone who even pretended to speak for the president or the White House, has ever made the slightest suggestion to me about granting any license or denying any license. Any assertion to the contrary is a bald misrepresentation. All that has come to this office from the White House is numerous letters of inquiry, of complaint, of suggestion, or appeal. In every single instance, these have been transmitted without comment or suggestion, just as thousands of similar letters are referred to by the White House to the Department of State, the Department of War, the Power Commission, or the Bureau of Entomology. But while the President has never discussed with me the matters referred to, he has discussed with me ways and means and possible policies to make radio thoroughly democratic and to guard against its becoming an instrument of injustice or unfairness to any and all political parties, to any racial, social, economic, labor, producing or business group, to any minority or any class. He has spoken to me of his determination to preserve the right of free speech and of a free press and liberty of thought. The President's wish is that radio shall continue to make increasing contributions of entertainment and instruction toward a way of life, a better way of life, for all, even the most illiterate and humble. I need hardly add that I share fully these aims. The President's interest in the broader aspects of radio's present and future, as distinguished from its license or quasi-judicial aspects, is rooted in his responsibilities as well as in his interest in free government. It is he who has the primary responsibility of appointing the members of the Communication Commission and designating their chairman as well. He may replace the chairman at any time, designating a new one. Now, what about federal censorship? Is the government going to blue pencil the dance programs and the crop reports and the bedtime stories? I wish to make my own position very clear on that. And I don't know of anyone who takes the contrary position. Here is my own. The Communications Act imposes squarely upon each broadcasting station the responsibility for censoring its program material. Each station must also determine who and what shall not go on the air. The law provides for regulation by the Communications Commission only through the periodic granting or renewal or denial of licenses to broadcast. The control of programs by the broadcasters is a field of public service which requires the exercise of an informed and mature judgment. It requires a high degree of discrimination to the end that the listening public may reap the benefits, but without the hurt or offense, from the magic of radio. This is as it should be. Obviously, the power of censorship and selection must be lodged somewhere, and the broadcaster is the one to exercise this power. An answer to the public for the manner in which he exercises it. Censorship by the Communications Commission or by any other governmental body is, in my opinion, impracticable and definitely objectionable. It runs directly counter to the genius of our democracy. As far as I know, no one has advocated government censorship. But if perchance any such measure should be brought before the Congress for consideration, a deep conviction would impel me to battle against it. Out of any such Pandora's box would spring to plague us innumerable and unimaginable evils. So let us lay the ghost of censorship by the government, which some summon to frighten us against our insistence upon the broadcasters censoring themselves. They must censor themselves, even if now and then it costs them money. Broadcasters hold valuable government licenses for the use of frequencies which belong to the whole people. The license privilege carries with it the high duty to keep constantly in mind the public weal. Many of them are scanning their programs critically and trying to better them. For example, I understand that the three national networks, NBC, CBS, and Mutual, over whose joint facilities I am reaching you tonight through their courtesy, are studying children's programs and bedtime stories to preserve or even build up their entertainment value and at the same time improve their quality. If this effort succeeds, and I believe it will, the regional networks and the local stations are likely to follow their example. Such improvement is self-regulation of the sort that is appropriate and healthful. There's another good example of it in the practice respecting the mingling of news matter with dramatics and with advertising. A few days ago, I held an informal conference with the heads of the three broadcasting chains about the use of such arresting terms as flash and bulletin in news broadcasts, dramatic programs, and radio advertising. I have felt, and so have many others, that such terms are sometimes used indiscriminately in a way to confuse or mislead the public. When there is big news breaking and the radio gets it, most people welcome a flash. The network's heads assured me that the word flash is now rarely used by any network, whatever individual stations may do. And they all took the position that flash should be used only for items of unusual importance and interest. They agreed that the words flash and bulletin should be used with great discretion in the dramatization of fiction events so that they may never cause general alarm. Larger questions loom up ahead in radio, however. It is being perfected further. Its range is increasing. So is its usefulness. And so, too, is its influence upon public opinion. Who controls it? Is there any single control, either legal or practical? We're going to find that out. When I came to the commission, I heard reiterated charges that monopoly in the worst sense existed in the broadcast industry. Whether these charges were true or false, I had no way of knowing. I believe that it is a vital public concern to establish the truth about this matter. I propose a thorough commission investigation into these charges of monopoly and related subjects, and into chain and network broadcasting, which this commission has authority from the Congress to regulate. All but one of my colleagues voted in favor of my proposal. On Monday, we start hearings in connection with this investigation. As I have said, its scope is extremely broad. We're going to investigate not only chain broadcasting and the allegations of monopoly in the broadcast industry, but also the nature and extent and effect of concentration of control of broadcasting stations by the same or affiliated interests in the United States. We're going to go to the bottom of the situation resulting from operation of stations by persons other than those authorized to operate them. That means cases where control has been transferred by leases, management controls, and other devices. The commission is also, for the first time, going to make a thorough study of transcription services, which, as you know, are becoming an increasingly important factor in radio broadcasting. When this investigation is completed, the commission will know and the public will know the essential facts about chain and network broadcasting and about monopoly. Upon those facts, the commission will base any necessary regulations and rules, and if they should be needed, recommendations to the Congress for legislation dealing with these problems. This impending investigation, possible new regulations, possible new legislation by Congress, our strengthened federal regulation without censorship, and a greater or lesser degree of self-regulation by the industry are bound to affect radio in important ways. They are among the strongest forces and potential forces which will shape the radio of tomorrow. Thank you.
You have been listening to a talk by Chairman Frank R. McNinch of the Federal Communications Commission, broadcasting direct from his offices in the new post office building on Pennsylvania Avenue in the nation's capital. Chairman McNinch chose as his subject radio today and tomorrow. He discussed some of the past and present problems of the broadcasting industry and the future outlook of broadcasting. He also dealt with the impending investigation of chain or network broadcasting and monopoly in the broadcasting industry, which investigation opens Monday, November 14th. The chairman also discussed the reorganization of the Communications Commission staff, which has been marked as a so-called purge. This broadcast originated through the facilities of WOL in Washington. This is the Coast to Coast Network of the Mutual Broadcasting System.